you know, glad to be here. I think what you're doing is very important. I think raising awareness about this, having people feel not alone, having people, you know, realize that this is something very common, treatable, that there are, you know, better days ahead.
But to be fair, that's sometimes how therapy works too. Sometimes you have to have a few wrong answers before you find the right one.
Yeah.
If you could please just increase your volume just a little bit.
Welcome to season 5. Who knew we'd make it this long? Hey, everybody.
Hey, welcome back to week 2 of Bipolar Girl. Hey, Doc. Hey, Dr. Amy DeRamis.
Hey, Steven.
How are
Rebecca,
you?
Peter.
Why don't we go ahead and introduce our author of the week?
We have an author on named Peter Vox, a retired school teacher and professional musician from Long Island, New York, who has spent his life battling anxiety, depression, and essential sadness. This book chronicles Peter's childhood and the origins of his mental illness, history with medications, decades spent in therapy, marriage, careers, journals written from psychiatric hospitals, and theories on how to handle your own mental illness.
Wow. Welcome. Welcome, Peter. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And, we are so happy, and I think just as we get through our current events, then we'll be excited to dig in and learn more about who is Mr. Vox. Amy, how was your week?
Good. Not much happened, but, you know, the teaching semester has started, and I've got 2 classes, both of which are really talkative, good discussions. Still a little bit obedient, but I'll fix that.
And something else happened really cool in your life over the off season. What did you do?
What did you get?
What did you get?
Your little baby.
Your new baby.
Oh, Alexandra. Yeah.
Yeah, Alexandra.
That's my new cat. Yeah. I got her at the Anti-Cruelty Society. They were having this adorable, like a Taylor Swift event because the Taylor Swift concert was in town. So they dressed up all the dogs and paraded them along the Chicago riverfront so everybody could see them. And then, since cats wouldn't really vibe with that, because cats, the cats were only like $13 that weekend.
$13?
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at, okay, so we'd like to like adopt a dog for our son, and it's like $300 to $500. That's just to adopt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, like I think normally it was like $175, but special event. So, you know, I could, you know, buy her supplies, get her... make a donation to the Anti-Cruelty Society, you know. So that was really nice. And she's a very good girl.
Yes, she is. Very friendly. And she's adorable.
She's beautiful. You call them tuxedo cats, right?
Yeah, they're tuxedos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty.
Yeah.
Now, do you have other pets, Amy?
No.
No, my last cat passed away a year ago, and I had her for almost 17 years.
I know the feeling. I know the feeling. Like, my Max. I didn't want Max at first, but when Max died, like, I was broken.
Yeah.
It was terrible.
I mean, like, with Morgan, when she was about 4 months old, she just walked right off the street up to the hospital I was working at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And this would be in like 2005 or something. And she started tugging on people's pants legs outside the emergency room, asking people to help her.
Aww.
And so some friends of mine absolutely never, 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 you know, snuck a tiny little street cat into the hospital and fed her and stuff, you know, where everything's supposed to be, you know, very sanitary. But eventually I ended up with a kitten and had her for almost 17 years. And then she passed. And it took me about a year to be ready to think about another pet. Because, that was pretty wrecked.
It's hard to lose a pet. It's like losing a member of your family. It's really difficult.
Yeah, it's it can be traumatizing. You know, it was funny when my mom lost some animals when I was young. I couldn't figure out why she was in bed for a couple of days with the windows shades down and depressed. But then, like, these little dudes become absolutely part of your family, and you don't realize how important they are to you. I know how important my Max is. I mean, my Izzy is, because every time we talk about flying and going overseas, I'm like, look, Izzy has to have a seat. She's a Great Dane. I'm like, you know, how do we get her on the airplane?
Do we get the dog on the airplane?
We're not putting her underneath, right? It's not happening. So, no, well, congratulations, Amy. Super happy. I hope she, it's a boy or girl, I forget.
Girl.
I hope she brings you lots of joy.
All right. She is. She's a sweet baby.
Excellent. Honey, how was your, how have you been?
Good.
Sure.
Yeah.
Tell everyone what's new in your life.
There's not much new. I mean, it's the same. It's going to be the same thing for a while. It's just school and kids, and there's not much new going on.
Well, you know, everyone here knows that I'm running for office, for example.
Yes.
And I got called an elitist today.
Yes, he did.
Yeah. Yeah. Martha's Vineyard elitist, Stephen McDowell, running for Congress. I said, you can call me a lot of things. I mean, but elitist is not one of them.
Elitist is pushing it.
That's pushing it. I mean, but hey, you know what's good? I told you that we will have a campaign when people start talking badly about you and or just start talking about you. Yeah. Like, so this is good.
Yeah.
Peter, the man.
If they're talking bad about you, it means you're becoming a threat, which is good.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yes. Exactly.
Yes. So how was your week, Peter?
How was your week?
Sweaty. I've been in a perpetual state of perspiration. Wow, I got that out quickly. I said that with all the seasons. Perpetual state of perspiration.
There you go.
There's been a heat wave in New York. So.
I can only imagine.
Hopefully some relief is coming soon.
I bet. I mean, you know what? When it's this hot, I wouldn't even want to get down in the subway. I'd like forget it. I'd just catch a cab or walk.
The subway cars themselves are when the air conditioning is working, which is most of the time, they're freezing, which is great. And the buses, when the air conditioning is working great, they're freezing too. You have to bring. I see people bringing sweaters with them, little blankets. They get cold. But the subway platforms are where it's the worst on the subways.
Yeah.
I can only imagine. I remember once we went to New York for our anniversary, and we stayed out in Queens, and we took the train. We said, let's just take the train down to Times Square from Queens, like beyond Flatbush. We were in Chinatown. It took like, I think, an hour and a half.
It was a long train ride.
It was a long train ride. I didn't realize how vast or how big that system really is until you like get on it.
Yeah,
it's
it was
huge.
A long train ride.
Yeah. No, that's very good. Well, that's good. Let's
you already played your song.
I'll play it again. Like,
you played your song. So you're here to talk to us about your book.
Yes.
And I find it very interesting. So tell us, what made you want to write a book?
It came about by accident. I was hospitalized for 14 months total. I did 11 months in a row, and there was one day, it was a Friday, during my 11-month stay, and my psychologist said to me, why don't you start journaling? She felt I was bored and wasn't really doing anything. And I said, okay. And she said, well, today's Friday. I'm going to see you on Monday. Write one paragraph for Friday, one for Saturday, one for Sunday. Three paragraphs, five sentences.
So journaling is an interesting topic.
That
and
is interesting.
I never am able to journal.
No, I mean, well, how do you actually get time to focus? Like what Peter was saying, I'm curious as to like, how do you get time to focus after a busy day?
From what I read about you, your LinkedIn and the book that, well, you tell a story. It
sure.
Ended up being a lot more than three paragraphs, didn't it?
It was Monday came and I had a smile on my face, and she hadn't seen that in a few weeks. And she was sitting at the table in the meeting room, and I slid the journal to her like if you were a bartender sliding a mug of beer to somebody. Mm-hmm. And she's looking at me and she goes, did you write the three paragraphs? I said a little bit more, and she opened it up. I wound up writing 66 pages. In a weekend.
Oh my goodness.
In one weekend. The floodgates opened.
I'm sure it was cathartic for you too.
I found it as I was writing. It became very cathartic. Mm-hmm. And I became very interested in seeing where I would go with it. Mm-hmm. And after I was discharged, I wound up filling up three notebooks. it turns out one of my fraternity brothers from college has an independent book publishing company. And I contacted him and he said, great, type it all up. And I was like, oh man, I got to type all this up now. So I spent a few months typing it up and editing, revising, and we published it.
That's excellent.
How long ago was it published?
It was December 2021, so okay. Coming on 2 years.
Okay.
So to what extent then, when did this event occur that you were in the hospital for 11 months? Oh, hold on. We'll get him back in a moment. No.
What happened was...
hold on, Peter. We lost you just for a second, and I was on a
cocktail of a lot of different medications, mm-hmm. and there were various side effects. And the thing with Ativan that I didn't know, that it can cause suicidal ideation when it's wearing off. Mm-hmm. So with poor judgment, when I felt the suicidal ideations and it was wearing off, I was abusing them. I was taking more and more. There were a couple of weekends I did that. And then at a certain point, I just couldn't take it anymore. And I felt I couldn't take it anymore. Mm-hmm. And in a moment of desperation, I wasn't really even thinking clearly. I felt the Mr. Spock mode, for those familiar with Star Trek, where you're not really feeling emotion. And I just poured a handful of pills into my hand and swallowed them. And I laid down and I didn't care if I ever woke up again. And I woke up luckily in the hospital in different clothes than I went there in. So somebody changed me. And at that point, that would be my, that was the fifth time I was hospitalized. And I knew that I was going to be there for a while. And at that point, I was okay with it. I said, okay, it's time to get some more intense help that I need. It's finally out of control. And I was more than willing to stay and try anything to stay alive. I have three sons, and I can't imagine the damage that would have been done to them had I not lived.
Did this event occur because you were having, like, your life was changing in some way, or did you...
It was a culmination of, I would say, 7 to 8 years of significant life-changing events. Mm-hmm. But you couple that with my pre-existing conditions and the combinations of medications that I was experimenting with, not on my own. They were all prescribed to me. But combine all those things and you get to a point where you don't know who you are anymore. And I'm a person, my anxiety and depression, the foundation is a fear of death. And for me to do a 180 and all of a sudden have two suicide attempts in 2019 from someone that was scared of dying, I knew something had to be done. And going back to 1996, I was prescribed Prozac, and I had a similar experience where I was hearing voices. I was living with a girlfriend at the time, crawling on the floor, screaming. I couldn't handle the side effects. And to counteract that, I was prescribed Xanax at the time, and I took a handful of Xanax, did sort of a similar thing. Not really thinking and saying, I just need immediate relief. And you don't care what happens to you at that point. You're in so much emotional turmoil. Thank goodness the three attempts if you're going to be a failure at something, fail at trying to hurt yourself. So
that's one thing that you do not want to be good at. So
no, you don't want to be good at that.
Yeah, exactly.
And you only have to be good at it one time.
One good time. Yeah. I, you know, so you mentioned about feeling, you felt different when you were on medication. Mm-hmm. What was that like? Explore that a little bit. Was it that you just got so used to the unmedicated you that when you change medications, it just puts you as sort of in a, it made you more self-aware?
What happened was I had been on Lexapro and Klonopin for since 1997. Mm-hmm. And it was, I felt that combination was helping. Mm-hmm. Then I got divorced in 2013. That same year, I got T-boned in a car accident, and which led to a back lumbar fusion surgery.
Oh my God.
My father passed away. I got divorced. I was forced out of my teaching position, which is, it's detailed in the book. It's a too long of a story to tell on a podcast. And all these things, it was just one thing piling on top of each other. And, I felt that, well, maybe, I'm not handling these things well because the medications aren't effective anymore. I've been on them for, 20, 25 years already. And so I started being prescribed things like Abilify, Effexor, and it was sort of willy-nilly. Oh, try this one, combine this one with this one. And there are psychological side effects, which are, lashing out at people. I lashed out at a group of high school friends. They don't speak to me anymore because of I sent out the nastiest email that I could think of and insulted these people the best that I could.
Wow.
So there was those sorts of things. There were physical side effects. I was in Walgreens and I was having leg tremors from, at that point, I would say that the drug I was taking at that point that was the newest was Abilify. And I was having such bad leg tremors that I was holding on to the shelves on the aisles so I wouldn't fall down. So, mm-hmm. It felt like one thing after another. And the psychiatrist I had at the time, she was somewhat new because the psychiatrist I went to for the longest time, he unfortunately passed away. I went to him for 16 years. So it's hard to find somebody new after that, especially someone that I connected with so well. And between all of that, and the new medications and new living arrangements and things of that nature. I imploded and
enough was enough.
Mm-hmm. enough to try to hurt myself.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Amy, did you have anything you wanted to ask?
Just to comment actually on like that complex relationship he's talking about that we don't talk about enough, I think, about, psychological side effects of medications, mm-hmm. and trying to sort out what's the person's symptoms, what are the side effects of medications. As you pointed out, there are times when there's a medication change that can actually increase suicidal thoughts in a really serious way. Mm. You've got psychiatrists handling the meds. Psychologists and other therapists handling the therapy side, they're not always talking to each other. And so, things get caught, a client tells me they're having more suicidal thoughts. I do the assessment, but, I would need to talk to their prescriber to be like, okay, are, suicidal thoughts attached to any kind of change in medication they've had?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's one of the most important things that stuck out to me.
Sure. Go ahead.
You run that risk with being, kind of changing your medication all mm-hmm. the time, because it's not working. So you keep trying something new, something new, something new. And every time, I swear, every time you try something new, there is a new side effect. Mm-hmm. And you have to figure out what that side effect is. Mm-hmm. of, right? Is it a side effect, or is it that the medication isn't strong enough and I need more medication? And so it's kind of this guessing game. And right. Unfortunately, us as the patients, we kind of fall into harm because we have to play this guessing game sometimes.
Right.
No, I think it's true. And coming from my perspective, being on, you know, sort of both sides.
Yeah.
You know, it is. It's almost like being a guinea pig in a sense, because you don't you don't necessarily like know what will stick and what your body will handle. I have a family member actually who early on in their treatment, they were on several different regimens and none of them worked. Old school lithium did.
Yeah.
That was the magic drug. And when I found out.
Sometimes the old stuff works. Like, that's why it's been around so long. Like, we've got all these new. And, you know, it boggles my mind because we watch TV and, like, every different commercial is a new commercial for a new drug for this is for bipolar and this is for depression and ask your doctor. And it's like, there's so many out there.
It seems like every other commercial. And now there's medications to help with the side effect of the medication that you're currently taking.
Yeah.
So the solution for your pill is another pill. I recently got off lithium because of the weight gain. This is my second time getting off of it. The first time I was on it, I was complaining about the weight gain. And my case manager said, she goes, oh, well, if you're concerned about the weight gain, there's a pill you could take, you know, to help lose weight. And that's when I had a eureka moment and I said, I'm tired of these, all of these pills being pushed upon. I was a gym teacher, physical education teacher. I used to be a personal trainer before that. And I had a caseworker who clearly wasn't taking care of her health, telling me how I should take care of my physical health.
Yeah.
And I felt it to be very hypocritical. And I felt like a number. I just felt that they didn't know enough about me and what I felt was important. The reason why I got off lithium again was because I gained 20 pounds and I'm 54 and I train almost every day. And I didn't want to gain that much weight. When I got into the when I was committed for the fifth time, I was underweight. I weighed about 170 and I'm 6 feet tall. So that's a little underweight. When I was discharged, I was 225 pounds.
Wow.
Yes. And I was exercising in the hospital. I was doing push-ups. I was lifting. I was doing bicep curls with chairs. I was walking the ward. And the food is fattening, and then you know you have breakfast three times a week. You know, there's one day's waffles, one day's pancakes, one day's French toast, and then you're trading with the other patients. I'll trade you my pancakes for your applesauce, and I'm like, yeah, you give me more pancakes, more syrup, more butter, yeah. So
and then meals also tend not to be terribly protein heavy, at least by a weightlifter standards.
Correct. Yeah. You know, so it's a slippery slope. Do you want, someone said to me, well, wouldn't you rather be a little bit heavier and feel better? And I said, yeah. I said, well, if I'm heavier, I'm not going to be happy. You know, that's for me personally, when I look in the mirror, I want to be happy with what I see. It feeds off the other. The movement of exercise helps me with my mental health, and then the visual results of it help me with my mental health. And so, if you're taking a medication that's stopping your goals, then you need to get off them. And I didn't feel at this time around with lithium that it was helping. Because I wasn't suicidal. I just felt that I was just having a rough time, mm-hmm. isolating a little bit, spending too much time on the internet promoting the book, even though I was having a good time promoting the book. But you're still on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, scrolling through things and scrolling through. You're still seeing negativity.
Yeah.
Even though you may not be interacting with it, mm-hmm. you're still reading these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it affects you. And then the next thing you know, you go online at 8 o'clock at night. You turn around, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and you have to get up at 6:30.
Yeah, Steven's real good at doing that. Steven's real good at, I fuss at him all the time because he doesn't sleep through the night. He's up all night. And as mm-hmm. soon as he wakes up, he puts his phone in his face. And then I'm like, why are you up? He's like, well, I can't go to sleep. And it's like, well, yeah, because you have a mm-hmm. phone in your face. Like, put the phone down. Because you do, you get wrapped up in it, and all of a sudden 3 hours have gone by, and you've just been doom scrolling.
Sure. It's similar. It's too much stimulation, even if you're having a good time.
Yeah.
You know, I could stay up all night watching YouTube and watching old music videos from MTV or old Looney Tunes cartoons or anything that I enjoy. But if you have a lack of sleep and you're not giving your brain a chance to reset, you're going to have a negative reaction to it. When I used to record music, there was a point where my guitar player was recording guitar solos, and it got to a point where he did, 10, 12 takes, and the engineer goes, "What do you think?" I go, "I don't even know anymore." And the guitar player said, "I don't even know anymore either." And he goes, "We all have ear fatigue, which means you've had enough. You've been overwhelmed by it. You need to step away, take mm-hmm. a break." And so that's where sleep is important and rest is important. Even though recording music is a fun process, you still need a break from it. Too much of anything is bad.
Right. And I say that a lot to our oldest. I say, you spend 18 hours a day on the video game. This was before he went back to school. And then the next day he either had migraines or he would be like feel funky. And literally it was too much. It's just too much stimulation. So I know he's old. Legally, he doesn't have to listen to me. Right. But he's 18. But I still say, look, buddy, go get some rest. Right. Get your butt into bed. Get some rest. You can't be overstimulated. And which leads me to my next question for you. When you were going through this time of healing with your young people, how did you guys, you and your former spouse, how did you approach communicating your challenges to them?
Oh, with my children?
Yes.
I was pretty transparent with my kids about it. My ex-wife was pretty transparent about it. It was an acrimonious divorce. So mm-hmm. There was a thing I made sure to do in the hospital was I would call my children every night from the hospital to keep mm-hmm. The relationship consistent. And it worked because when I was eventually discharged and I was less than 2 miles from their house where the hospital is located. And when I went over there after I was discharged, if you haven't seen your kids in almost a year, you would think there would be this tearful reunion of hugging and I missed you and all these things. And I walked into the apartment. They were like, "Hey, Dad, come check out my new video game and come see this poster." And they were very nonchalant, and I chalk that up to keeping communication open. Mm-hmm. So
I tell you, there's nothing.
It's not like you were gone, because you talk to them all the time.
Yeah.
Well, that's true. That's very true.
But also they're boys.
Yeah, I mean,
that's true.
Do you know how many times I get my feelings hurt? Like, the other day I had to tell my youngest, I said, like, "Look, dude, we don't not speak and say hello and goodbye in this family. We just don't." Mm-hmm. Some people do. Doesn't happen in my family. Like,
yeah,
we speak.
He'll wander around and not talk to anybody for days.
For days.
I need subtitles for their grunts.
Yeah.
Like, how was school today?
Yeah, exactly.
What is that? What does that mean? Do you have gas?
Yeah.
Do you have gas? Or, something go wrong? It's you know, I'm lucky that they enjoy my presence. And my twins are 16, the youngest is 13. And right now it's a phase of, we like you here, but be quiet.
Yeah.
And unless we're doing, you know, we enjoy the same television shows. I'm trying to get them to exercise more and be active. You know, they have different interests than I did growing up and different interests than I do now. You know, you weave yourself in and out of what they're doing. And I think most important is just being there and being present in their lives. And I think, I feel and I hope that what I went through doesn't have any long-term effects on them, because mm-hmm. they know I was in psychiatric hospitals. Sometimes I'll make jokes, you know, about it to loosen things up a bit. There hasn't been a real deep conversation of what they felt about it yet. Sometimes I'll sort of like bring it up. You guys, how do you feel about what happened? They're like, you know, they brush it off and they go, whatever, you know. And I don't know if that's ambivalence toward it, or if they don't feel like talking about their sharing their feelings yet. Or if they're actually okay with it. So we'll find out as the next few years go by, and we'll see.
How would you, Amy, tell somebody to approach something like that? Like, I don't know how I would tell my kids or what I would do with my kids if I ended up in the hospital. And I mean, we're very open about my mental health with the boys, and they know everything that's going on. But like, how do you handle that as a family when you come back, especially when you've been gone so long?
That's a good point.
Well, I mean, I think Peter set it up really well just by staying in communication so that things went smoothly when he got home. Because so like, you know, would have been great to have that celebration maybe, but maybe it's even better that it wasn't needed because you were so consistently in their life in the way that you could. And that's really good. And, you know, if possible, bringing other family members in to help, you know, hey, dad's coming home, mom's coming home. You know, how are you feeling? How do we want to handle this? And I think one of the biggest things is keeping explanations age appropriate. You know, a younger child, 5 years old, 10 years old, needs a very different explanation from somebody who's in their mid to late teens. And then just kind of like having family meetings where everybody's on the same page about how to handle it. People are kind of given the freedom to, you know, handle it their own way a little bit. Like maybe one person wants to engage with it less than another. But, you know, we're all together on supporting the family member. And everybody's expected to be supportive to some extent. And that can be hard just because, you know, depending on the type of mental illness, the symptoms, you know, then you get into the complicated situations where maybe under the influence of a mental illness, somebody's done a lot of harm. And that's where this gets really messy. Because, you know, how do you strike a balance between supporting somebody and recovering from a mental illness so everything can be better, and having some accountability for what actually happened? If they really hurt somebody in some way, whether it was verbally, physically, whatever. And so with children, the other thing is like, in addition to prioritizing somebody's recovery from a mental illness, you got to prioritize the children being safe and feeling that they're safe before that can really happen. So, you know, it gets complicated. Children have particular needs, especially around knowing that they're safe sometimes. If there's been a realistic threat of some kind, and then just, you know, getting everybody enough on the same page that the person who's recovering feels supported in their recovery, even while there might one day be a day of reckoning about some stuff that happened. Adult family members, you know, a little more choice about how much they engage. But a lot of times you can negotiate if this person isn't ready to support, maybe they stay in the background a little bit to limit the damage. One thing I mentioned in my book is like a lot of times when families are trying to have these discussions, I kind of suggest that if possible, I spend some time doing something like totally neutral, enjoyable, play a game, watch a movie together, have some time that feels good and has nothing to do with mental illness for a little while before they, right before they have the discussion. Have a good meal together, something like that, so that you create a little prelude where everybody comes in feeling fairly good, if possible.
Keep it safe. Make a safe and calm
environment.
Try to
create that safe space, exactly.
Yep. No, that's great.
That's really good. So where...
I feel like there's no right answers, and if you don't get it right, absolutely no judgment, because this is really, really hard to get right.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, you can always try again, too. And that's the one thing that I've always found with my kids, is they're very forgiving. Thankfully, children are very forgiving. So, Peter, where can people find your book?
It's on Amazon, Kindle, Walmart, Target, and there's 42 audiobook apps that it's available on. So if you Google the title, The Psych Ward Notes, Surviving Anxiety and Depression, it'll come up on all the formats.
Okay.
And that's exciting. And then, so what are you doing now professionally?
After I got out of the hospital, I had a few jobs. I worked at Federal Express. I was loading trucks from 3 a.m. to 7 a.m. Mm-hmm. And while I loved exercise, I was 51 at the time. So from my neck up, I loved it because I was getting a workout in. But from the neck down, the knees started aching and I was in pain.
Amen, brother.
So I stopped doing that. I actually got trained to become a home inspector. I have no construction experience at all.
Oh.
And I took a course. I spent $3,000 on a course. I took the national exam. I passed it, it's supposed to be a hard exam. I passed the exam, and then I realized that I didn't want to be a home inspector. And while I was a teacher, I spent 2 years in graduate school to become a guidance counselor.
I'm sorry. I just had to.
That scared me. Him and his sound effects.
I'm sorry.
So you're at home. You do. I lost my train
home
of thought.
Home inspection.
No, I wound up not doing it during sometime last year. Before I started training to become a peer specialist in October of last year, and I learned about it over the summer and what peer specialists do. And because I've always been interested in psychology, and when I was a teacher, my students would tell me that I should have been a psychologist, I should have been a guidance counselor. I was always being called in to handle conflict mediation with students. I would be called into the office for children that were having fights that weren't even technically my students in my gym classes. And I would walk in, I go, why am I here? They're not my students. And so they didn't have a fight in my class. Well, they feel comfortable with you here. And because I was the teacher, you talk to them in the hallways. I can do impressions of cartoon characters. I would do lunch duty in the cafeteria. So I was very visible to the student body. So between that and the courses that I took for the 2 years to become a guidance counselor, and the free training that was offered in New York State to become a peer specialist, it felt like a no-brainer. And I got hired in January of this year, but it's called The Bridge Mental Health and Housing Solutions, and I'm part of their peer specialist team.
That's exciting.
The job entails you have a caseload of people, and you help them recover from past trauma. There's people that need help getting housing, getting jobs. Some people need someone to talk to that has lived their shared experience, and some people enjoy talking to someone that has more in common with them than maybe their therapists, and they feel that can relate to them more than the therapist. That's mm-hmm. obviously not discounting mm-hmm. therapists. I'm a big proponent of people going to therapy, but to have someone, it's sort of like going to group therapy, but one-on-one, and it's a little more relaxed. And you do wellness recovery action plans with them. You find out what their triggers are, and you help them move forward any way that you can. I've taken people need to be escorted because they need someone to advocate for them. Mm-hmm. Even one guy hadn't been to a podiatrist in a few years. His feet were out of control, let's say, without getting into graphic detail. So, I took him to the podiatrist, or another gentleman is having trouble with housing, and he had to go to housing court. So I went with him to the courthouse. Mm-hmm. So you do things like that. A woman I was with today, we went food shopping because she's a little bit insecure about walking around the neighborhood, and she's a little unsteady on her feet. But she wants to be more independent, and there's a lot of paperwork that people are unfamiliar with, right. with getting housing, signing up for if they need to go on food stamps or disability, or applying for to get into a school to get their GED, and they just need someone there as a friend and an advocate, and so they don't feel alone. So it's a rewarding job. There's tough points. There's been some tough days.
Right.
Though.
Well, and what a way to like take what was lemons and turn it into lemonade and give back. Mm-hmm. What a way to give back and turn it and be positive. Mm-hmm.
There's when you talk to somebody that's been through it, and they say, I get it, I know. Mm-hmm. And there's one gentleman I speak to, he's divorced. His ex-wife has a boyfriend who has a great deal of money, and he feels this competition now to be a better father than this gentleman. And, I went through those sorts of things. You don't want to see your children with another person spending more time mm-hmm. With your children than you do at points. So you understand that hurt, that tinge that it gives you, but the hurt to your pride a bit. Mm-hmm. So when someone says it, tells you about it, and you go, oh my God, I know that feeling, and it's genuine, it makes them feel less alone.
Yeah. What a way to be a good guardian angel here on Earth. I think mm-hmm. that's great. Well, oops, that was the wrong. That was the wrong. I wanted to go. There we go. It is that go. Time in our show because, see, Rebecca's over here playing with the hot buttons. Like,
sure. Yeah, but I'm not touching them, and you're the one that's touching the wrong buttons.
We're getting ready to move into
Proverb.
I can't turn that down.
Yes.
I thought we said that was too low.
No.
All right. So, okay. That's okay. So we're getting to the proverb where every week Rebecca, we call it proverb, but just like words of aspiration. Sure. Rebecca will read one that she chose, and we'll go around the horn and talk about what it meant to us.
Where did I find it? Oh, okay. So it is a German proverb.
Okay.
And it says, starting is easy. Persistence is an art. So I guess with me, I would say, I'm just turning it down a little bit. With me, I would say that, yeah, starting is easy, but it's always harder to keep going in a lot of aspects in life. And so you have to keep going, even when it gets hard.
Amy, what say you?
My 11 billion hobbies that have been picked up and dropped when another shiny hobby turned up. And all of the books behind me that, I've read most of them.
Most.
I was getting ready to say, I'm looking, because like now for everyone out there in bipolar land, we are actually now recording again, looking at each other's face on virtually. Mm-hmm. And Amy has this backdrop that like, she looks so smart right now. I'm kind of like, wow, I don't even know if I should be in the same room with you. You look super intelligent.
Yeah,
so I was actually thinking I was channeling a little of my 90s goth phase today.
Yeah.
a little bit. Nice. But I agree with you. All the hobbies that you start and you never start back up. I had a, I do needlepoint, and I had a needlepoint that took me over a year to do because I just kept putting it down and putting it down and like not picking it back up. So yeah, persistence is hard. How about you? Mm-hmm. What do you think of it, Peter?
I look at it as, when I was a personal trainer back in the day, and we used to talk about days when you didn't feel like going to the gym, you're just not in the mood to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can make it to the gym on the day that you really don't want to go,
mm-hmm.
it's going to make it easier to go on days that you do go.
Yeah,
when you're not in that mood. Okay. So it on the days when you're feeling the worst, sometimes you have to force yourself to make a change. It can be very difficult, you know, to get out of bed and
yep.
Keep up with exercise and, you know, do your laundry or you know, the dishes aren't going to clean themselves and things like that. I always break it down to with people. I said, sometimes you have to just take care of yourself as a human being first.
Yeah.
And take care of the basics and be persistent with that. Eat, get some exercise,
mm-hmm.
Go outside, take a walk, change your scenery to change your frame of mind. Mm-hmm. I learned that from a therapist that he was a big believer in cognitive behavioral therapy, mm-hmm. which I enjoyed. Mm-hmm. And it really just came down to, you know, change, do something physical to change your mindset. And there's so many avenues to choose from that you can find something that works for you.
Mm-hmm.
And stick with it. So, something that brings you joy,
right?
And brings you happiness, and keep doing it as long as you love it.
Wise words. Wise words. Well, you know, it's funny because right now I feel like we're stretched thin, and I think when you read that, like, it really kind of it kind of smacked for me.
Mm-hmm.
It hit right in that area of like, you have all these ambitions, and then you find yourself like, oh, I can do it, and then at one point you're staring at a mountain. But the question is yeah, it might slow you down, but you have to finish each one. Because if you don't, you set the precedent for, you know, for like giving up. So you don't want to do that.
Yeah. I mean, the way you eat an elephant is one bite at a time.
Why? Elephants, that's a lot of meat. What about like a horse at least?
Okay, but you would still do it one bite at a time.
That's true, you would. Well, all right. Well, Peter, thank you so much. Do you want to, listen, why don't you give yourself a shout out? Tell everyone where they can find you if you are a public person like this. Some people are just not, but if you have a Twitter,
sure.
So yeah.
I'm on Twitter. It's Peter Vox. Right on Twitter, it's at PPVox 555, I believe, or you could just Google my name and it'll come up. I'm on Facebook under Peter Vox, on Instagram under Peter Vox, and I leave one out, LinkedIn well under Peter Vox. Mm-hmm. So I'm always posting, promoting the book, talking about different ideas about psychology, anxiety, depression, sharing music, and trying to help people, and giving hopefully good advice and good insights to people. And I've been doing some public speaking as well, and that's been interesting.
That's great. That's really great.
Just getting myself out there and seeing, you know, it's, you don't, I don't want people to feel the way that I do sometimes or that I felt in the past.
Yeah.
In terms of what? Like loneliness? In terms of what?
I'm sorry, say that again?
In terms of what? Feel like you felt in terms of what?
In terms of feeling suicidal, mm-hmm. Letting anxiety get out of control, letting depression get out of control. Mm-hmm. There's some confusion that goes along with it. For me, this all started in 1978 when those floodgates opened, and I started therapy in 1984. So lately in the last 15 years or so, I'm seeing people that are older, in the 30s and their 40s, they're developing anxiety and depression for the first time ever in their lives. And it's quite a shock to them. And it hits them hard where mm-hmm. I'm used to it. And I can describe it in a way where they understand it and they go, oh, yes, that's what that feels like. Or this is what my panic attacks feel like. And mm-hmm. I describe it in the book in great detail. Mm-hmm. And I did that on purpose because there's so many physical symptoms, you know, of anxiety attacks or symptoms of you're falling into a depression. And dealing with it for so long, mm-hmm. I think I have a healthy perspective of it. And also, you know, with the experience, you know, and the knowledge that I've gained of so many years of therapy and everything that I've learned, I think I have an interesting angle. Interesting angle and perspective of it.
No, I mean, it sounds like it. And thank you so much for coming and allowing yourself to be vulnerable and share, you know, sure. a little bit of your journey.
I appreciate you having me on.
Really Amy, do you have any, I'm sorry, Peter, I wanted to see, before we wrapped up, does Amy have any like closing thoughts?
Yeah, just one thing that Peter talked a lot about that I really appreciated and it's so real is just the complexity, how a medication that's great for somebody over here is giving huge side effects over here, mm-hmm. how, you know, you take one medication to fix the side effects of another. How the different parts of treatment interact, bringing in family life. So I feel like we had a great episode tonight because we really got into the complexity a little more mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. about how all of these pieces interact mm-hmm. and how complicated this is.
It is. It is complicated. Nobody ever said it was easy. That's for sure. And if they did, they lied.
Yeah, they did. They really lied. They really lied. Well, no, again, Peter, thank you so much. And I know you were saying your final thoughts. Go ahead. What do you want, any final thoughts to share with everyone?
If somebody is contemplating hurting themselves, trying to commit suicide, they want to end their lives, and they feel they have nowhere to turn, I got to realize that that's the signal. When you get to that point, it's like the bat signal. Mm-hmm. That's when you get help. If you feel there's no other way out, then call for help. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with collaborating with other people. Another music analogy is, you know, if you're having trouble writing a song, bring in other musicians, you mm-hmm. know. And work with others, and you know, you bounce ideas off of each other, and it's okay to ask for help, and especially in this day and age where there's more people now than ever that are willing to listen to you and willing to help. It's and lots of services are free, like NAMI is one of them. That you take advantage of these services and yeah, just get help if you need it. And, you know, one moment, one really bad moment will pass. It's hard to live through that moment because you don't think it's ever going to end when you're in the middle of it, mm-hmm. but try to keep on in the back of your mind that this is it. This is where, when it's time to get help.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Mm-hmm. Definitely. And knowing when to reach out and who to reach out to is very important too. You know, that's, you know, I have safety plans for reasons, for just for that reason, you know, like when do you reach out and who do you reach out to?
Sure. And if you don't know what to do, you just call 911.
Yeah.
They'll, you know, where you end up, you'll end up in the emergency room, of course, but they'll get the ball rolling for you and get you the support that you need to a place like the bridge where I work, where it's a comprehensive, organization. They're, like I said, help with housing, for substance abuse, for anxiety, depression. We have house psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers. So, you know, these types of places are available. There's in New York City, there's drop-in centers, a place called the Fountain House, where it's free of charge, and they have group therapy, they have activities, they have day trips, art therapy, music therapy, just to keep you from isolating yourself. And I think that's the worst thing that you can do for yourself, is to cut yourself off from the world. Like my friend Billy says, he's an idle mind is the devil's playground, I think, if I'm saying it correctly. Amen. And just really being around other people is very important. Even if you feel you have nothing to say, at that point in time, just having connections with people is a great deal of help.
Yeah. Don't isolate.
No, that's the perfect. Thank you so much. Honey, did you have any final thoughts before we move into your next segment?
No,
The next segment is we will introduce our song or music of the week. Go ahead, honey.
Okay, so it's Trinix. Trinix is a French duo. So we've been doing French a lot.
We've been in France quite a bit.
French duo of producers and musicians from Lyon, formed by Josh and Lois in 2012. So they're from their childhood. They devoted a real passion for music, and they learned to play all kinds of different musical instruments.
That's Louis. Josh and Louis?
Josh and Louis. Sorry.
I don't want to be upset. Like, oh, she called me Louis. Lois.
Lois.
Yeah. No, that's really awesome. All right. Well, thank you again for joining another week of season 5 of Bipolar Girl Beyond with Amy, Rebecca, and I. We so enjoyed it. Get in touch with us if you'd like to be on the show. Peter, thank you so much. And just good luck with all that good work. Amy, anything else you want to say one more time?
Just that I think this was a really great episode that brought a lot of different pieces together.
I think so too, Amy.
Awesome. All right.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, everybody, once again for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter.